Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning. I'm not used to these mics. We have these funny little filter screen over it. It's a little bit of a throwback, our engineer Matt said. But all right, I'll get used to it. This is the Main Course OG. It is Thursday, September 19th. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here in studio with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
Thank you.
And Brandon Hoy is going to be in a couple minutes.
I think he's outside trying to rent his backyard for $25,000 to a couple who might get married there.
All right.
It's a good cause.
I'd like an invite to their
for.
Wedding. Can we get invited? Maybe we can sell ourselves as like on air, like live commentary from the wedding. We can do the play by play.
The play by play with that wedding speech gets a 4 out of 10.
Will you dress appropriately? You don't like tuxedos.
I don't like wearing pants during the summer or fall months.
I prefer
shorts. One time I got evicted from Gramercy Tavern. I got carried out by Mike Anthony because I had shorts in the back area.
You got
so
evicted.
Now every time I buy a pair of pants before I go there.
That is true. We were there on Monday for actually one of our guests today in studio, Evan Tesler, did the tavern takeover celebrating the 25th anniversary of Gramercy Tavern. But we also have Eric Koss on the line. Is he with us from the Alameda Sun?
I'm here.
What's on the cover of the Alameda Sun newspaper today?
Well, you know, I was kind of like setting up for this one. I have a good one for you. There's our city is so beautiful that a photo of our mud won an honorable mention from the 2019 International Photography Awards.
Slow news day.
No, man, it's you know, it's
you have beautiful
our city
mud
getting an international award for its beauty, and it's basically our mud.
Is this so the same mud that gets shipped to the major leagues to rub the baseballs with?
No. But the way this guy captured it, it's like a lovely reflection of the sunset. It's got like all the colors of the rainbow, and it's pretty impressive. So, you know, I mean, we like to appreciate art in the Alameda Sun. When our local artists win an award, we like to draw attention to that. And it's not a slow news day. In fact, we have an interview with the new city manager above that, but I didn't think you'd be interested because you don't know the guy.
Oh, okay. No, I like the mud story. I like the mud story.
No, the mud story is great.
So,
well, I'm just back from the San Gennaro Fair.
I was going to ask you, how many fried Oreos did you eat?
I went to visit my friend Dan Sharp, who's running the meatball shop stand, and he was like, do you want to know where we are? I'm like, dude, I'll be on Mulberry Street. I'll find you. It took me an hour to get 6 blocks. That fair is like 10 blocks. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's packed.
It's 10 days. And it's
very successful.
It's in its 93rd year,
I think. It's 14 days because it's 2 weekends. Or so what does that make it, 10?
I read it was the 12th to the 22nd,
okay.
So I don't know. Do you count the, I think it's 10. But
so I helped and cooked the meatballs. I mean, I was even in charge of putting the tomato sauce and some water on top of like 20
balls. Did you have
balls.
To wear a hairnet?
No, this was all done. He was on the corner of the Cannoli King, has that corner, so he can rent out the stands. He controls that corner, and so the meatball shop was on his corner and was allowed to use his kitchen.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. So you don't, even if you don't have a restaurant on Mulberry Street, if you are part of the Lower East Side, you can.
If you're part of Little Italy, you can participate. I don't know who is part of that, you know, world or whatever, but
did you find our friends John Tillis and Tim Caspari from
Pasquale Jones? They weren't out there, but they had a nice stand, and with those nice restaurants there, it makes it a fantastic fair, and I love it. New York style, it's truly half a mile long. It's not like two blocks or something, you know. It's like five times as long as Beale Street.
Was it like highbrow, lowbrow, like old school Italian, new school Italian?
I think mostly old school. There might have been some new school people, but mostly old school.
I like it. So our guests in studio today are two really good friends of ours. We have Chef Evan Tesler of Manhattan. I think it's the newest addition, although you've been open a year and a half or so now, to Danny Meyer's Union Square Hospitality Group. And we also have Chef Sib Cheeseman of Gran Electrica, one of our favorite Mexican restaurants here in Brooklyn in Dumbo. Good morning, guys. Sib, are you awake yet?
Not really, no. It's way too early for me right now.
You do the 12. No one can see us.
Like I'm dreaming a little bit. I don't know what's going on right now.
All right, so, you know, around dinner service later, you'll be like, was that all a dream?
Yeah, I'll dial in my comments later.
All right.
So follow HRN Twitter for Sib's comments to all the questions today.
The main course OG on Instagram. Exactly. We'll wait for it.
Well, maybe he'll wake up with the round robin.
For sure. So we're going to jump into our weekly based section. The round robin question today. Coming up is National Coffee Day and International Coffee Day. What's your go-to morning coffee? Sib, do you miss the morning? Do you not even have coffee?
I have coffee at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So, my go-to is an Americano with oat milk.
Which I did just get for you from Swallow. Very, very particular. Are you lactose intolerant?
Just not really a big cheese guy.
Even though your last name is Cheese Man?
Yeah. not milk. Not really. Like, I'm not really a big fan of milk.
All right.
That much, so.
But to honor milk, real milk, because Anne, my wife, is a cheesemonger, and she says you shouldn't call it milk because, like, an almond doesn't lactate, you know, is what she says. I was thinking that only milk from cows can be called milk with a hard K. All the others have to be called milk with a soft K.
Wait. Milch. Why can't goat milk have a hard K?
What's that?
Why can't goat milk have a hard K?
It does, yeah. Anything that truly lactates in the traditional thing. But okay. If it's not milk, it should be called milch with a soft K to protect milk.
Moving on, Chef Evan Tesler, what is your go-to morning coffee, if any?
Coffee.
Just coffee.
Coffee with cow milk.
Cow milk.
I go for a nice caramel coffee.
Black coffee.
Almonds don't lactate, Brandon.
In the coffee shop, they were talking about this thing yesterday called the flat white. Did you guys try that yet?
I'm all about some sort of alcoholic beverage inside my coffee. I like to start the day off strong, just really get the muscles flexed,
yeah,
and just really just jump Hot into Brandon. My day. You
That's
know?
How you build a six-pack.
Rum and coffee.
Cafe Coretto.
We got to make this happen for Brandon right here. I'm going to share some of my iced coffee. My answer to this question is, if I have the time, I actually drink Pete's Coffee. I know it's a big brand, but it's my favorite. We brew it at home. Mm-hmm. And by the time I get to work, I have a pretty watered down iced coffee from Brooklyn Natural here on the corner. But today is Swallow, who was very polite to
me. I do
this
find Swallow's coffee very, very good. I mean, it's so much closer than Roberta's. Roberta's has good coffee. I mean, some of these coffee places, I'm bothered. They dial up certain tastes too much just to be different and distant. I'm like, that's not a balanced coffee. I see that you're unique and I recognize your coffee, but you'd rather be recognized for just being the best coffee, not one that's super acidic. Or
I don't like cold brew.
We use variety here, which is
used to use Stumptown.
We did, but we try to stay local.
Good.
We keep it in the neighborhood, you know.
Well, I don't know what I'm supplying you with, but here you go. And there's some cow milk in it, so I hope you're not lactose intolerant.
So tell us about the martini, Emily.
Oh my gosh, I am the wrong person to ask this question to. I'm going to turn it to you. So the martini is a totem of American culture alongside apple pie, hot dogs, blue jeans, baseball, and a two-car garage. Hemingway's most quoted martini line came in A Farewell to Arms in 1929, where the protagonist, Frederick Henry, meets with his romantic interest at a hotel bar and orders martinis. Quote, "The sandwiches came and I ate three and drank a couple more martinis. I had never tasted anything so cool and clean. They made me feel civilized." Is the martini the most important cocktail, Patrick?
Well, I do think that cocktail culture makes me feel civilized. Like if I'm traveling around the country and there's a cocktail bar, I feel like a million bucks. I feel like a gentleman going to, you know, a round table discussion. I'm part of a cool community, a late night community.
The only part is it also sparks all of your anger because the second you step up to the bar and the guy next to you can't figure out how to order a drink, your rage just turns you into this tomato of hate. And
yeah, I do get into a lot of bar fights, but I do think that when the bartender finally comes after a half hour or 20 minutes of being like, oh, you have to know your drink. You can't at that point get him and be like, could I see the menu?
Is your first one always a martini?
Well, it is the biggest bang for your buck. You know, you only need one or two, whereas if you have beers, you might drink five or six. And if you don't know the bartender, it's sure to be pretty good. But if I know the bartender, I'm like, make me a drink with gin in it or something like that. And then they do their thing.
Evan, are you a martini guy?
I love Gibson's.
Yeah?
I love them. But I agree. Anywhere you go, they can make you a martini. You don't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'll try different drinks. But I like to start a lot of meals off with it.
Now, in Italy, martini is a bottled drink that they open the cap and it's called martini. It's
what is it? Martini. Is it a martini?
Well, you were just there, right, in Italy? Or were you?
Yeah, well, maybe 2 years now. Okay. I loved it.
Martini is its own drink, right?
I don't quite remember that. But
they're now bottling Negronis here in New York. There's like a local Brooklyn company. They're very strong. You pour it over like a single...
Roberta's is a pioneer of the bottled cocktail.
I know, but you
first place I ever saw it.
Brandon, do you sell them in stores? No, I have to come here for it, right?
What
a bottled cocktail.
We don't make those. We buy those from somebody else. Yeah, but also in the tiki bar outside, it's easy because it's just like when we get like slammed back there, it's just like so much easier.
Batched.
Totally. And prior to that, we did batched cocktails. That was the way that we could like get through the summer. It's just like you have a couple batched cocktails and you're just like flying through them. But this way, we just have all of them. They're pre-bottled and stacked. I used to always try to get them to do Nutcracker because I was like, this is the shit. We should just do Nutcrackers, fill up some backpacks, and the bartender should just walk around the backyard and just be like, no.
That kind of grosses me out.
I mean,
I don't know.
Sib, what about you? What's your cocktail? I guess
that's not any grosser than like a Gatorade cooler filled with a pre-batched cocktail. So,
my cocktail is a Mezcal Negroni, actually. Yeah, I've been really big into Mezcal lately. So like either Mezcal or gin, but like a Negroni, like that's definitely where I like to go. It's just like, you know, the right amount of like bitterness and like boozy flavor. And it's just like, you know.
Is there a certain time of day for that drink or?
5 o'clock as well.
Yeah, 5 o'clock. Like either before or right after the coffee.
Why 5 o'clock? Like why not 4? Why not 3? What's the difference?
Just it's all the now. Same.
Well, I don't know. Siv doesn't start till noon every day, so we think that that's still his coffee hour. He might need to wait till, you know, 10.
I feel like what time you woke up is important. If you wake up at 12, like starting drinking at 5 is probably okay. But if you wake up at 5, like start drinking at 12 is probably okay, right? It's like how many hours have you been awake before you started drinking?
That's circadian rhythms.
And are you an alcoholic?
Circadian rhythms with Brandon Hoy.
All right. Well, I'm not really a Mezcal martini girl, really but hit. I like that it's a totem of American culture. That it's. I mean, I guess that's like the admin era.
Very few things Madison came Avenue. From the U.S. Cocktail culture came from the U.S. Like in the world, like you go to a place in London, they didn't have cocktails back then in the 20s or Paris or Italy. Now they have cocktails.
I don't think London still doesn't have cocktails. I still think when you go to London, you're like, you get
Pim's
like
a
gin and then they give you like a cup of something else.
Basically, you have together. To pour your own.
Yeah, I don't think they legally can even make a cocktail for you. I think you have to pour your own. I think that's just like how it works in foggy old London town.
I think
Guinness has a real scissor hold over that.
Exactly.
Liquor situation.
All right, I'm going to transition here. Bon Appetit magazine just came out with their list of top 10 restaurants in America.
Top 10 in all America?
Yeah, I don't know. And New York is unfortunately not doing so well on this list. We have Conby in Los Angeles, Cow Noodle Shop in Dallas, Long Oven in Richmond, Virginia, Okra Bakery in Detroit, the Elysian Bar in New Orleans. I'm not even going to get the New York place name right.
Copitium.
I actually don't mind this. Being here in New York, I don't mind this. This is like when the 100 in the world was like always in France.
Yeah.
And then like finally it started becoming more diverse. You're like, oh, this is nice. It's like it can't always just be New York. It's like nice to see that there's restaurants all over the United States that are good. And
what do you think about this being getting the top 10 list? What do you guys think as chefs of restaurants? Manhattan, Grand Electrica?
I think it's interesting to, it's nice to be on a list, obviously, but I mean, I think it's important to know kind of like what's the criteria? What's the best in what? I mean, I think it's interesting because a lot of them are picking restaurants that do something really well.
That's Evan Tesler from Manhattan Restaurant.
That's true. That's me.
So you don't know that there could be a barbecue place here and a high-end Japanese restaurant. You're like, those are two different categories.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, I think it's, especially if you're traveling and you want to check out something that's new and interesting and doing something special, but I think a lot of times they come out with these lists and you're not sure how they pick them.
Yeah, let's move to that. What is the criteria? Does anyone actually know what the criteria is to
Patrick
make one
pulled
of these
this particular
lists?
List. Do you know what this one was? I don't know. I'm going to pull it up. But
if they call it a top 10 list, there's no criteria. These are the top 10 places to go out and eat, whether it's a barbecue place or not, which makes the list all the more outrageous, I think. But Sib, what do you think?
I guess it's just like whatever is unique to the area. I guess like if you go to the middle of America somewhere and you're getting like awesome Japanese food or something like that, you're like, oh shit, like, this is not something I was expecting to see here at all. So I'm assuming that that's what it is. And then also, I guess if they're following all the current trends of being like responsible and like, where they're sourcing from and, whatever, how long ago the animal was, born and like all of these different things that are like, they're checking off all these lists. I think that that's kind of what it is, because at the end of the day, like, I grew up in New York. So like for me, food is food. And like, if it tastes good, it's great. If not, maybe I won't go back to that place. But, I guess outside of New York, especially because New York is kind of like a food mecca to a certain extent. So if you find something that's like comparable to what you would find in like New York, outside of New York, then, I guess that's probably like the criteria. That's what I would say anyways. Mm. Like,
I did look it up. This was the Hot 10, America's Best New Restaurants 2019. And the
spicy
editors.
Hot?
No, not spicy hot. But
see, that's different than top 10 restaurants. Like, that's not the top 10 restaurants in the United States. These are hot takes.
Hot takes.
I just
these are like, let the New York Times. This was the New York Times?
No, this was Bon Appetit.
Oh, Bon Appetit. This is Bon Appetit's like way to stay relevant across the nation, not just in urban areas where people already know what they're doing. They're like, how do we sell Bon Appetit in Dallas? Well, let's start like putting restaurants from Dallas in these things. This is an attempt for them to globalize just like everybody else is. They have to start being more inclusive. They can't just be like, hey, everything happens in New York, Chicago,
mm-hmm.
San Francisco, LA. I mean, LA is a new thing. Like, last 10 years, LA hasn't been historically a hotspot for food. It's just really recently that it has been. San Francisco is probably more known for its culinary. I mean, they have the CIA and Napa, and they have, I mean, you have the Valley, you have the Bay Area.
So we often talk on the show about like ascending and descending food cities. Evan, Sib, do you guys like, are there certain cities on the rise? Like, I don't know, Sib, you said you grew up in New York, but if you had to move, where is there a city that's like would be cool to be a chef right now?
And a city that would be bad
to be
a chef in.
Like, I feel like Detroit's having a moment, according to this list.
I feel like San Francisco's oversaturated.
Yeah.
Detroit is having a moment. I have like one of my really good friends lives out in Detroit, and I guess it's like I think like probably one of the criteria is like the level of danger too. So like New York, like in Brooklyn, like you'll come to Brooklyn, it's like seedy and like it's like, oh my God, what the hell is going on? And you're like, okay, cool, I found something good to eat and I can get home safe. So that's probably a part of it too. So it's like the more dangerous the city is and the better the food is, you know, like, so Detroit definitely, I think, is coming up right now. I think maybe like Florida, you know, Miami, like, you know, Fort Lauderdale, like, I feel like they're having a little
Fort
bit
Lauderdale's of having a moment. People are like, rent in Miami is too high. It's peaked.
What's yeah. that? They're, the Oakland to Miami?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah, they actually
good comparison. Oakland, I never thought
Oakland
about
Park
it like that.
Park out there in Fort Lauderdale. It's super clean. It's beautiful. You know what I mean? And, you know, they're starting to get a lot of, like, they're starting to do a lot of farming and stuff like that. So I guess that, yeah, probably, like, Miami would be a good place to go. Or, like, Fort Lauderdale, like, you know, southern, like, mid-Florida. And then a place
would you say New York is a descending city?
I don't know if it's descending. No, there's too many people out here for it to mm-hmm. be, like, descending. But it's just, like...
People love saying that on this show, that Evan, this is a descending city.
New York City? Ascending? Descending? Would you leave it?
Probably, I don't... The dream is to leave at some point, I guess.
Oh. You know?
But not really. But maybe close by. I think there are a lot of places you can go and try to bring just like good food or good techniques and back into sustainability and sourcing, you know, to different either areas, maybe Long Island or, mm-hmm. You know, places oh. where kind of it's taken for granted that you have people and you can serve whatever you want, you know.
Don't make them come to the city for the food, bring the food to them.
Yeah, but I think that comes with, you know, it's tough. You know, you go somewhere else, you have to first build trust before you just, otherwise people think, oh, it's some New York chef coming in and doing something fancy, and then no one wants to come over there.
You know, there's like tons of places that have been overlooked as far as like what they produce, you know, in restaurants. And
you mean cities or neighborhoods?
Cities. Mm-hmm. All over the place that the internet has given, like, shine the light on. There's places that have, like, you know, culturally diverse, like, areas, like Houston, where it's just, like, the Vietnamese food in Houston is, like, banging. And you probably wouldn't know that until people start, like, traveling around and, like, showcasing on mm-hmm. Instagram or whatnot, like, these types of places. So there's places all over the United States that have had, like, really rich, like, culture that... based around food that nobody gets to see.
You know, one thing,
like the Phoenicia Diner. I mean, yeah. It's because of things like Instagram that people beyond right. of a certain community actually travel for food. And now we all go, I mean, I know I do. I travel for good food. I don't just eat what's convenient.
But if you think about places that are set up to be ascending, I look more to like the quality of the food locally produced by there. So you start looking at places like Maine. Like think of all the seafood that comes out of Maine. There's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of great seafood restaurants like on the Eastern Seaboard north of Massachusetts. There has to be.
This is a little bit of talking about. It's right. Anne had an interesting thing. This is a little bit of a tangent, but she thinks there should be like a kind of junior year abroad or an exchange program of sorts in the U.S. for kids in the U.S. where like your two daughters would go to Missouri for 12 weeks and the Missouri kids would come here, because those cross-pollination things would probably bring a lot more understanding of like the middle of the country and all that. But I thought that was really cool, like a green
piece. That sounds like unity. I don't know if that's where we are in this country right now. No. I would say unity is not really on the forefront.
Putting high school kids together for, you know, or having them cross-pollinate.
I don't know. I grew up in New York and I'd never heard of like the 4-H farming program, and we don't have things like here like that. Like, could you go and join one of the like 4-H farmers in Missouri, and I don't know,
would they accept you? But yeah, if there was an official, what did that call the thing with that Kennedy started, where you would go, not Greenpeace, where you would go and live in a foreign country and help them build bridges and all that and then come back? You know, that.
This is the group to ask. Like, everybody here is like, Kennedy, who? Kennedy.
Like, the Peace Corps people. It's the Peace Corps.
Peace Corps, right. Thank you. He's like these idiots in New York. But I will say this about top 10 lists. A top 10 list should almost never change if it's a true top 10 list. I understand these were the hot ones. Top 10 list. I also like.
Wait. You're saying that nobody. nobody has the chance to join the top 10.
Come on. You know how many times we've had this argument, Emily? This is like...
It should hardly ever change.
How many episodes have we done? This is the same... We're just... He's saying the same thing again.
What about
moving
on?
Move on. Wait, this is my question.
Evan, you can
I just want to say I listened to two of these last night, and you brought it up in both of them.
Okay.
But I do agree.
Can we hug?
I agree. They should hug.
I want to hug because yesterday was National Cheeseburger Day.
Oh, I always
happy National Cheeseburger Day. Say bye, hug you
day
too.
Day after National Cheeseburger Day.
Cheeseburger Day.
I think it was a pretty weak hug.
What are your thoughts on cheeseburgers, Sib?
Is there a Mexican cheeseburger? Do you serve one at Grand Electrica?
No, we actually off beef.
Oh.
Yeah.
Completely?
Completely, yeah.
It's good for us.
We use we actually use bison, but we don't do a burger anymore. It didn't really work out that well.
But you don't use beef at all on your menu?
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
Like we have lengua, but that's bison tongue.
Okay.
Yeah, so like we don't use like any kind of like cow product.
Was that just for sustainability reasons?
Yeah, sustainability, cost? You know, costs like, you know, it's like 1,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef or something like that. And just
it's
like,
bold.
You know, just like, you know, it's just, you know, pretty much like a bad, you know, impact on the environment. So I guess for us to be responsible and do our part, you know, we decided to.
That's, wow. Yeah, good decision. That's one of the first I've heard of that. But
so do you have strong opinions about cheeseburgers, like do's, don'ts?
I love cheeseburgers.
He's like, well, we didn't have one at our restaurant, so I went next door.
I eat cheeseburgers other places, but yeah, I love cheeseburgers.
You an onion man? Thin patty?
Not raw onion, I would say, or probably not as thick as most places cut their onions, because the onions, like when it's super thick, it's like... You know, it's just too much. It's like too, like, you know, pungent. But like, you know, caramelized onions, like, you know, something pickled or something like that. I definitely like that to kind of like soften the acidity. On
blue cheese, cheddar cheese, American cheese.
I like a good Gruyere. You know,
every now and then I do like blue cheese on a burger.
It's like one out of 10.
I agree.
Maybe.
I do it like once a year, and yeah. I love it.
It depends.
I'm the same way. It's like one, like I just get that knack one time.
I get
time.
An itch
and it's
for
like
it.
That's the time actually when I do bacon usually. And me I rarely too. Do bacon on a burger either. But it's like blue cheese and bacon, just mm-hmm. every once in a while, that thing just it just gets in my mind. Mm-hmm. Like now it's there. Yeah, it's probably gonna be this week. It's probably gonna be this week that it happens.
Eric, what about you?
Yeah.
Eric Koss, what about you, burger?
Oh, yo, yeah, he disconnected a while ago. He hasn't called me back. Called him.
Matt, right. Do you want to give your answer? Cheeseburger? You could be Eric Koss.
I'm no Eric Koss. I don't eat meat. So.
I love even the McDonald's burger. I mean, I have to say, the taste is good. My kids want it via Uber Eats, so sometimes we order it, and it's delicious. I mean, who's joking?
I disagree.
You
and
think
I understand,
it tastes bad?
I think it tastes bad. And I understand the idea because my wife is just like, she like loves it. But it's like
nostalgia.
Nostalgia. It's literally based on like your brain's function to be like, I just remember this and it reminds me of being happy as a kid. And I think a lot of people have that. But I don't think if you just blindly tasted it, you would be like, this is a nice burger. If you did a blind taste test with a bunch of burgers and McDonald's was in there, you wouldn't be like, that's the best one. I guarantee it.
Especially not after our talks today of we need some blue cheese.
I always have Fruity Pebbles after my McDonald's. So yeah, maybe.
All right, I'm going back to sustainability here. So one oyster filters about 30 gallons of water per day. So this past week, thousands of oysters were released into the New York City waterways to help clean them up as Governor Cuomo pledged to make restoration of New York State's waterways and aquatic habitats one of his top concerns, calling the effort Revive Mother Nature. So basically, we destroyed the oyster population and the oyster reefs, which was the natural filtration system. Original oyster reefs could actually filter the entire volume of New York Harbor in just a few days.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody wrote it in a newspaper, it's got to be true, right? I wish Eric Koss was here right now. He could vouch for that statement.
My God, is that true? One oyster can do that much? I mean, one group
30 of gallons of water per day, one oyster filters. Does that mean we shouldn't be eating them? Do we
yeah,
need to leave
like
them be?
Yeah, that sounds like one dirty-ass oyster. Oh, my God.
No, I wasn't thinking. Oh, I didn't even go there. I meant, like, should we be preserving them? Should we leave them?
Well, I mean, this, you're not wrong about that.
A Hudson River oyster is probably Hudson River special.
Yeah, just imagine like a Newtown Creek oyster. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, I mean, you're not.
Evan Will Manhattan would be serving a Hudson River oyster tonight.
It would be cleaner if you digested it and shit it out. It would be cleaner.
You should, if Cuomo ever totally comes possible. In, you should be like, Governor, we have a Hudson River oyster.
But also, Ann is insane. Ann is like, all these people, these environmentalists, put one oyster in there. It'll change the whole program. I'm like, no, it won't. One little oyster can only do so much. I mean, now it's dealing with oil slicks and these.
They're spending, I read, I think it was like between $2 and $5 million on this like initial wave of this project.
Did you hear about the city's way to get rats out of the subways? They've built this pool of water and the rat goes up and then it drowns in this alcohol. What? And each box can contain 20 rats. They basically drown in a liquor of some sort that poisons them, and 20 per, and it's like tens of millions
of dollars
being spent.
Please tell me which subway stops to avoid.
Yeah, it's a big white box.
Have you seen them?
With a ladder that they climb. Very strange. Yes, they showed it. There was a big thing in the Times.
No. Have you seen them at any subway stop?
So just as humans, we should be careful if somebody starts planting these big pools with ladders and like there's like palm trees everywhere and they're like, come on in. And they're just like mass death everywhere.
So
this sounds like a horrible
speaking
trick.
Of mass death. So Oregon Public Broadcasting reported this week that Eastern Oregon ranchers have been finding mutilated cattle in their fields. These are cut up purebred bulls with no blood, just missing body parts that have been precisely removed, even stitched up. No one can figure it out. One of the theories is aliens. Another is Satanists. What are your theories?
Alienists.
Why do they always go straight to aliens and Satanists? Like, first of all, I watch a lot of Netflix. There's a lot of fucking crazy people out there that probably just Dahmer and shit that are just like keeping body parts, animal body parts in their freezer, waiting for their time to strike on humans. Again, this is the same guy that's going to build the pool that lures everybody in to certain death.
But what do you do? Like, haul away the cattle, bring it. There would be blood specks. How do you have... Do you put down plastic bags?
First of all, there's tons of people that hunt. You can field dress just about any animal. In the field, like, you shoot a deer. Sometimes you, like, hang it on a tree and you field dress that thing.
There's no bullet hole. Wound. There's no wound.
Well, maybe it just... Maybe they just jump on the back straight. Sleeper hold to the ground.
Evan, you got any theories?
Pull out the knife.
You gotta be really strong to do that to a bull. Maybe it is aliens, then, if that's the case.
What if it's just the actual... What if the ranchers just needed some publicity and they did it themselves?
Well, that makes way more sense, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but how does that help them sell more cows?
Yeah, I'm unclear about that part, but...
It brings attention to their plight. You know?
I mean, it's probably aliens. I mean, it was National Cheeseburger Day.
It was National Cheeseburger Day. Well, there's this new strategy. I don't know if you guys read, there's a new way of killing animals where just through the use of irony... You make them feel depressed about themselves, and they just fall over dead. And
so they sent Patrick Martins in to cattle whisperer.
Literally sounds like this show. Like, I know every day. I'm like, this is Patrick's plot to kill Emily and I.
He'll just kill us slowly.
We're slowly dying every day.
Well, I'd like to end this part of the show with an inspiring story. Emily just read an eater about public libraries sharing and loading non-book items.
That was supposed to say loaning.
Loading. No, but they'd load a van for you. Are you saying they don't have anyone to load if you ordered a lot of this stuff? Did you know about this? Libraries around the country offer cake pans and other kitchen tools in their collections. In fact, Hillsborough Public Library in Oregon is one of the often cited examples of the successful library of things. It offers 900 different items for loan, not including books and media.
Did you guys know this exists?
No idea.
I feel like...
That's pretty awesome, though. It's like, how often are you cooking, like, a upside-down cake, and you're just like, I'm just going to do it today, but I'm not going to buy the pan. I'll just go to the library, and I'll get that, like, one with the little hole in it that nobody really wants to keep in their pantry.
The bun pan, yes.
So if the delivery service doesn't include a plastic fork and knife, you could just call the library and get your own
plastic fork and knife. Yeah, and then return it.
Yes, exactly.
But I'm wondering, I did not do my homework to know how many New York City libraries participate in this, but I think it's great for like family.
I think it's great, but it depends. Sorry, this is not.
This is Evan.
Sorry, sorry. Civ,
but yeah, yeah. This is Evan. Yeah.
All right.
Go, oh, Evan.
No, I mean, I just think I love the idea of it. I agree. You can't store all this stuff, especially in New York City apartments. I mean, I have already way too much kitchen stuff that falls over and can't store it. But I guess it depends how clean that library is that you're returning it to.
Right. So I did read that like some of them you can, they have on for loan like air fryers, like Vitamix mixers, like things that maybe you also are not just, you know, the $10 Bundt pan that you don't mind having in your life. But I thought it was really cool, especially for kids or, you know, if you're a teenager who's learning how to cook or bake and you want to take on your own project, you can go and check it out. But
Snoopy snow cone maker. If they have one of those, I'm checking that shit out tomorrow.
Yeah,
let's do this.
All right, I will come back to everyone on this about if New York City has a good Library of Things program. But I sent this to my brother, lives in Hillsboro, and I have four nieces, and you know, I thought it could be like a cool thing for them to take on a project. And I was like, there's 900 items. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most people, the companies I've heard of, like, go and buy you the thing and deliver it to your house. That I get, but this is where you return it. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, it must cost 10 cents.
How do you track that? Like,
I think they sign it. No, they must sign it out like a book.
I mean, it's a book. Just, yeah. Like, how do they keep track of a book?
That's what I mean. Like, you know,
you get charged a fee for like, what don't they do later?
If you never go back, then you just have a free air fryer.
I mean, what's that fee for a vitamin?
In case you don't want to use it on
Amazon
or something.
Maybe the library reports you to the police.
10 cents a month.
Do they like theft. Just use the collections? Like, you know, do they like, you know, do they send a bounty hunter after
I think they probably do. They probably actually put you into collections. That's exactly what they do. That would be the easiest format to do it. They have all of your information. They can just be like, you didn't return the air fryer. Now we're putting you into collections. You also may have to like put a credit card on file. Who knows? They might just like hold a like, you know, they might just be like,
you will
for
be
these
found.
High items, like high priced items, you just have to like
what
leave
if
a credit
you have
card
to leave and... your driver's license.
Oh, maybe. You have to do that
leave your wallet.
How do you get it home?
If you're driving, how do you get it home?
That's a good point.
Yeah,
especially
well,
in the
ensure
suburbs.
That they would never lose anything.
It's like when you play cornhole and they make you like give them your license for the beanbags, and yes. You're like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why would I steal these stupid beanbags? But I'm going to like take them home for my home cornhole court? Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I can buy
I like
a beanbag.
They do at the bowling alley where you have to give them one shoe. I guess that you probably leave one shoe and then you could take an air fryer.
Oh, I forgot about
know,
that.
You do that, you know?
And they accept flip-flops at the bowling alley. You could be giving them a lower value shoe than their own shoe.
It could be someone else's shoe.
Yeah, you yeah. Someone else, you still have shoe from yeah, the store.
So you just go to like Goodwill, you grab a shoe, you go get yourself a pair of bowling shoes.
Yeah. Well, you know what they do in Goodwill? They put only one of the shoes. So if you steal it, you're missing the other shoe.
Yeah, but the bowling alley only
but that
takes
works.
One shoe.
That works for the bowling alley. Yeah. Just you get know, that one shoe.
And you know they do that shoe. At department stores too. Yeah. Like at any shop, there's always one shoe.
They
on
haven't
display.
Thought about the bowling alley when they did that.
All right, before we go to break, if you were to find out tomorrow you are lactose intolerant, what would be your last dairy supper?
Sweet Danish cheese. No, just kidding. Really? Probably blue cheese. Fondue.
I think it depends how bad this lactose intolerance. Like, what happens when you eat the cheese? I don't think I can give it up.
I can't give it up.
No, if you were told you're going to be lactose intolerant tomorrow.
No, I know.
No, he's saying
like,
I'll take the stomach ache.
I'll take the day
in bed.
I'm pretty sure I am lactose intolerant and all I eat is cheese. So I just suffer a horrible life of foul bathroom time.
All right. Basically, I think the only person here is Sib Cheeseman, who doesn't really like
ironically,
cheese.
Ironically, the cheese
really
man.
Like cheese.
Yeah, I don't know. I
No queso for you.
No queso.
Right. But you use cheese, right, in Mexican? What,
yeah, of course.
What's that
I
white
use cheese?
The cheese?
I don't really eat it that much. But, you know, I Cotilla. Would say I like a nice little... I like crispy cheese. You know, like some Ooh. Kind of frying cheese. Maybe like from the Dominican breakfast. That'll probably be like my last... You know, meal.
What is a Dominican breakfast?
So
please
Dominican
tell me.
Breakfast has like it's either mofongo or yuca. Then it has like eggs, like you know, salami, and then frying cheese, which is amazing. I don't know how that shit works, but you fry it. It doesn't melt. It just gets crispy. You know, it's like really tasty, like awesome. So maybe I think just like you know, Dominican breakfast with extra frying cheese would be my final cheese meal.
I'm in. I'll try it.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'd like to know what frying cheese is, but you know, I'll take it. Yeah.
Sip like doesn't halloumi. Care that he's lactose intolerant in this question. He's like, no, fair it'll enough. Be a celebration.
Not lactose intolerant.
No, I know.
You know, I don't want people to think that my stomach is like bubbling right now. Just the
thought of cheese. I got you oat milk. I got you oat milk. You're
I
good.
I like oat milk. You know, you're it's good. Really good. They know, it's the milch. Cheese conversation makes me a little nervous.
Yeah. What did you say happened over there?
It's oat milch.
Oat milk.
Oat milch. Brandon, that was my theory. If you want to save milk, cow milk, you know, regular lactating animals as milk, and all the other like soy and stuff would be called soy milch.
All right, please cut him off. We're going to take a quick break. hope you don't mind. All right, stick around. We will be back after the break with Evan Tesler and Sib Cheeseman.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How did they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combined their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm the host of What Doesn't Kill You here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with journalists, authors, scientists, or activists to identify and explain some of the key issues in our food system. I've done shows on food waste, labor issues, meat production, water, you name it, I cover it. You can find What Doesn't Kill You wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. This is the Main Course OG. Brandon, hit it. You got the sampler. Go for it. All right. This is the Main Course OG.
No, they cut me off. I think what happened was Matt tried to put new sounds on the sampler, but it's like a sampler from the 90s. So when he pulled the card out, it was like a floppy disk. And he was like, I don't know how to get sounds onto a floppy disk.
Is smoke supposed to come out?
It wouldn't work. It was really weird stuff.
You tried to put it into your CD drive?
Yeah.
Do you want me to bring my Vectrex over?
Brandon and I were just talking about that? He met someone yesterday also named Emily Pearson. All right, we are broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brandon just told me he met another Emily Pearson yesterday. I would really like to know who she is. Please get back to me on that.
I will.
Okay, please.
I will.
Please do.
Maybe she was like very confused by the conversation where I was like, Heritage Radio?
Maybe she was confused that you were calling him Emily Pearson. And
no, she had a name tag.
Oh, really?
She had a name tag on.
Someone is trying to be your impersonator.
Ooh. You met her at Urban Space? All right.
Doppelganger.
Which location of Urban Space? The one at Vanderbilt?
No, Lexington.
All right, I'm gonna go later. I gotta find who this is.
No, I'm really interested. She didn't work there. She was like having a. She was having like a thing and I don't know a thing.
This is like right, where you gotta Elaine get me more... and Seinfeld found out that there was a mannequin in her image doing terribly positioned things at the store. So she took it out. She's like, you can't have me doing this.
But she looked just like Elaine.
Yeah. The guy who made the mannequin was like secretly in love with the
All right, I'm going to have to look into this. So we are in studio with Evan Tesler from Manhattan and Sib Cheeseman from Grand Electrica. Evan, you have quite the resume. Gramercy Tavern, Untitled, and now Manhattan. Tell us something significant about working at each one.
Wow, that is
a loaded question.
Really deep loaded question.
How come they never came up with the name for Untitled?
It's under consideration. Okay. Yeah. They're almost there. It's where I came up with some suggestions. But
yeah, give us
no one.
One
wanted to
no.
Yeah, I
so say Gramercy Tavern.
Like titled but forgot?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a good one.
White
space. Name yet to be known.
You know, there have been people TBD. Working at Untitled, people come through the restaurant, and this happened like every few months, where you'd ask them if they want a table, and they would just, oh, no, we're just here to see the exhibit.
Oh, my God.
Take pictures of us and walk around. And I think
like they thought you were...
That the entire restaurant was an exhibit in the museum, and that everyone was sitting and eating and cooking as just part of an exhibit.
So what was your Gramercy Tavern? Give me top lesson, top thing you take with you the most.
I mean, look, I don't want to make it super cheesy, but I met you through Gramercy Tavern.
Oh, really?
That was pretty awesome.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, good job.
And, you know,
tag
just,
that.
I think, yeah, tag it. That's our live studio audience.
Yes.
yeah, I mean, I think at Gramercy, you know, we really learned, like, the love of sustainability and delicate cooking, you know, while mm-hmm. also... just all about flavor, you know, maybe there's a reason it's so many people's favorite restaurant. And I think even through working there, it became mine and I go back and eat all the time. And
wow.
Do you prefer the tavern or the dining room?
I guess tavern. I think it's a little more relaxed and fun. But also when you know people there, if there's anything really special in the main dining room, they make sure you get it. So
what about Ooh. Untitled? You worked with Suzanne Cupps there.
Suzanne Cupps.
So what do you take from that place more than
definitely love and respect of vegetables and just how to use them in a way that really helps them shine. I mean, we get almost everything from the farmer's market and or a few
providers that we love.
Yeah,
talk
I know,
about
but the
meat.
Vegetables are great. Okay. We also
no, vegetables are wonderful.
At Untitled.
And Manhattan, the 60th floor of Liberty Street.
The new windows on the world.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, it's a pretty amazing view.
Windows.
You've also had the last two restaurants, Untitled and Manhattan. It's a pretty awesome place to work as a chef. You're definitely not in the basement. You're definitely not behind, you know, in the dark. You get just
it's pretty
views.
I mean, I remember working back at Cafe Blue downstairs and, you know, and even upstairs, no windows, nothing. Felt like a casino, except there were clocks and you were always late. but you'd walk outside and have no idea that it snowed that day anything. Yeah, the views are pretty awesome. Manhattan is a big space. I think just kind of navigating, you know, trying to make it fine dining-esque in terms of how it feels when you eat there and the food and the techniques and everything, mm-hmm. but then also trying to get people to understand that we want it to be more relaxed. You know, you can come in, you can wear your shorts and mm-hmm. your Yankee shirt if you want to, Patrick.
Wow, good to know. You right do in. Not you do not have to buy a pair of pants for dining at Manhattan.
Yeah, shorts are... Okay. That's
you're so high up. I mean, at that point, no one cares. But what strengths do you bring to the kitchen? Like when you go and you're like, hey, chef, I want to be this guy for you. What are you talking about? Like, what is your best strong suit for the kitchen dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I really love teaching, new cooks, growing new cooks, and everyone around, I think, you know. We're with each other every day so long. There's so much to learn. And yes, you learn, I think, best by making mistakes, but why not teach people by the mistakes I've already made? But yeah, I love that. Growing a team, nice, strong team, and just being passionate about everything we do.
That's awesome. How many sous chefs are at Manhattan?
We have about six or so, which seems like a lot, but it's a pretty big space. I think I didn't realize at first, but just between the prep room and the main kitchen and just walking around, kind of need a lot of people, and I think also we're working on the new kitchen culture where people don't have to work 6-7 days a week all the time, so having enough sous chefs so that we can also have the time off and have families and mm-hmm.
sounds like a good
kids
work
just
life
aren't
balance.
Getting to like understand what real work is like, where we are jammed in a basement working 6-7 yeah. days a week, you had to wear pants, like all these crazy things. Yeah. Just we're really like negating their sense of work by doing this to them.
Yeah,
they're just gonna roll through life being like, life is just shorts and 4-day weeks and like windows and all these great things.
Well, people don't
we didn't get
hard.
Any of that shit.
Yeah, I
like
know.
My life in the kitchen was horrible. Like, yeah. Chefs that yell at you and burn you as shit and throw things at you. Like, I agree. I worked in many restaurants where you would just, like, get out of work and you had no idea. Like, you don't even know what, you don't know how light it is going to be outside. Yeah. You have no idea when you get out. You've just been buried.
Sometimes you've been buried in filth and anger and humility
and all types of nasty shit.
But also how we raise our kids, you know? I mean, Anne will carry Max until he falls asleep and all the lights on and TV, you know, everything loud.
You're trying to say that we're all coddled now?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I was like 10, 8, 7, 5, I had stone cold darkness. It was just the black room. I couldn't see anything. There was no one being like, oh, we'll leave all the lights on the hall because you're nervous. You know, it's like times have changed.
I think nightlights existed when you were a kid, but you know, you didn't have one, I guess.
No, not up where we were.
Sib, you work in a little bit more of a no windows kitchen at Grand Electrica.
Yeah, there's like two windows on the swinging doors so I could like peek out and like see what's going on at
but
the
you're
bar,
right
maybe.
By the water, so it has well, a nice open a... energy to it, even though you're in the basement.
No, we're not in the basement. We're like
you're right the by the floor. By the back patio, which oh, is right. beautiful.
Well, yeah, kind of like so we're in the middle of the bar in the back patio. It's cool. Like it's a smaller kitchen. It's like, you know, it gets a little tight in there, but you know, it's nice. Like, you know, I would like, I guess that I would think that I would want to have an open kitchen, but sometimes, you know, like for certain things, like you don't want everybody to see what's going on.
So on that note, chefs often say when they retire, they'll open their perfect restaurant. What would yours be? Open kitchen?
Place you want to grow old in.
Yeah, actually, my perfect situation would be just like a kitchen in the middle of the jungle somewhere. I grew up in New York, but I lived in Jamaica for a little while, and like, you know, that's the first experience I had with farming, with like, you know, butchering animals, like getting fresh fish and stuff like that. So definitely like, you know, burning wood in the middle of the jungle, just like, you know, it's awesome. It's like, you know, just like, you know, the farm is right there. You just get the animals straight from the farm. You get the vegetables straight from the farm and essentially just like cook up whatever, you know, right there. And then like something that's super comfortable.
Chefs are great. They always want to open a restaurant that doesn't make any money. That's like, oh, like every time you ask a chef, like, what's your perfect restaurant? They're like, you know, this crazy idyllic shit that like would
that
never
no
make
one
any.
Can get
yeah,
to.
Yeah, no,
that's
yeah.
Retirement.
It's like, retirement. Like that's a chef's dream to make a restaurant that like only three people come to a day.
Well, Alice Waters said she would like.
It's true though. Yeah,
we'll come.
She wanted a big table in her backyard, and sometimes it'd be empty, sometimes it would be two people, sometimes it'd be 25 people, just all scrunched in. But
well, you're probably not making money anyway, so why not have the dream restaurant?
Yeah,
also
it's also retirement. Like, that was the main part of it.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Like, if I'm retired, that means that I had enough money, and then now I just don't want to do anything I don't have
to. Do you even charge for your food at this idyllic spot?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think that translates to the chef-driven restaurant and the idea of what a chef likes in a restaurant. And I think this is probably one of the problems why you see these chef-driven restaurants that, like, usually, you know, they don't last very long because they're like, you do have to survive, especially in New York. Rent is fucking crazy expensive. Labor is expensive. Food is expensive. Like, it's a hard business, man.
That would
so,
be funny.
Like, if you go into it, like, idealistically being like, I just want to pay and I want the best possible food I can for like six or seven people a day. It's going to be hard. Yeah. Who was it that we just talked to that has the little hand-drawn noodles? And he's just like, if I could do it over, I would have more seats.
Rich Ho
of Ho Foods in the East Village. But no, I mean, I'm not a chef, but if I were to have my own spot, I think the idea of if you can afford it and if rent and labor and everything, you know, works for you, to be just like one or two people, open only a few days a week, and have a limited number of seats.
Just invite people to your house.
But that's basic. But that's exactly.
Like,
but,
why? What do you mean a restaurant? Okay. A restaurant is a place that is for a community for them to go when they don't want to cook. Like if you
What's
just want to have a house
name?
Party, like build an outdoor kitchen and have a house party. That's a great retirement plan. Just be like, I don't want a restaurant. I want to retire. Maybe I'll make some food by the pool for some people.
What was that like Prodigy kid's name?
Nice. You have a pool. That's good.
Yeah. What was
well,
that?
That's still what you meant
in
by
my
that.
Retirement. Yeah, I don't even have a pool. I have a lazy river. Like and like I'm working towards this. That like I'm retiring at Old Fartsville. a community of uh-huh. like-minded people who just want to drink at 12 and sit in a lazy river all day.
No matter what time you wake up.
Do I get free membership if my name is Patrick Fartens? That I'm named after the town. All right. Well, can we talk about more serious things? The challenge of Mexican cuisine. So when you were told that you'd be the head guy at a Mexican restaurant, did that make you feel like you needed to travel to Mexico and do something authentic, or are you treading new ground on it?
Not really, because once I started getting into, like, you know, studying Mexican cuisine and just, like, you know, I guess getting more into it, it's very similar. Like, my family background is West Indian, like from Jamaica. So there's, like, a lot of ties between, like, Taino Indians and Mexico. It's kind of like, you know, the Caribe Indians and stuff like that. So it's a lot of there's a lot of connections there. So for me, like, kind of growing up with that already, you know, with that skill set, I guess, you know, I've already known a few things. But it's really just, like, learning all the different, like, you know, ingredients, like, you know, like with huilacoche, which is like corn fungus, and then like huizontle, and like all these different like herbs and stuff like that. So it was interesting. I definitely want to go to Mexico. Like, I haven't been there, but the closest I've been was like San Diego or like, you know, LA, and going to visit my
Mexican food scene friends. In San Diego is banging, huh? You probably learned a lot there.
Honestly, I learned a lot. I did. I learned a lot about like Mexican food, like from being in LA. For sure, just like, you know, hanging out with my homies from like East LA and stuff like that. So, yeah, like it's a little challenging because you can't really go that far outside of, you know, the parameters. Especially at Grand Electric, because we were like, you know, authentic Mexican, and it has to be like, you know, very specific. So,
and you guys have a location in Napa, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is really funny because the two like kind of like hot Mexican restaurants in Napa right now are Grand Electrica and Thomas Keller's. I forget the name of it now, which is really funny because Napa is completely littered with authentic, like truly authentic Mexican restaurants that are like, you know, probably the per person average at most of them are probably like $12.
Because and there's here a you lot go, of Mexicans have these in Napa, right? They do work. Tons. I mean, tons in agriculture, tons. Right?
And it's like an incredibly like rich Mexican culture in the valley. But it's really funny that those are the two, like, even for locals who are just like, you know, these, like, they'll tell you, they would never put those in their favorite category of Mexican restaurants because they all have, like, their one. But I could guarantee you they probably go to those two restaurants more than they go to their favorite because it's like, Napa misses those kind of exciting restaurants that feel like people are doing stuff. It's a small town. So I think they're very popular because they're just, like, packed with people and the bars are fun and all this stuff, but it just seems interesting to me. I don't know. Was that I was aiming for a question here, and I just
no. I think it was a good educated remark. So mm-hmm. Before we wrap up, I know both restaurants are participating in Go-tober. We're very excited.
Yes.
Starting on October 1st. But any other news? Any other events? Things we should look forward to?
In November, we're planning on doing a mezcal dinner.
Hmm.
So. We're just, like, you know, using it as an opportunity to educate people about mezcal and just, like, you know, the change, like, the new trends in, like, you know, alcohol, I guess. And we're just going to do a nice food pairing and, you know, mezcal pairing. And we're going to have some reps come through and, like, talk about it. And so that's pretty much what we're planning on doing. And then we also are going to have a party for Dia de los Muertos at the end of October. So that should be fun, too.
Killer party.
Yeah.
That party kills.
It does.
Mortos.
You'll hang your
with irony.
We'll hang your goat skeleton.
Evan? I love how hard you had to like force
I had
that
to
in
go
there.
One more.
Yeah, you just like kept jamming it in.
I always think I'm gonna like kill it, but yeah, then sometimes totally. My jokes just don't hit.
Yeah,
I think we. Yeah,
that's not the first or last time that'll happen in this show.
Evan, Manhattan, anything we should look out for besides?
Are you opening
killer
a higher
views?
Restaurant yep. on the higher floor?
We're picnics on the roof. The open. I think we're just going into our we've done a full year now, finally feeling fully staffed, which is nice.
Cool.
And just looking forward for the year. And I think now that nothing planned yet, but talking about our New Year's ideas and the 4th of July, although we tried last year, we couldn't quite see the fireworks, but
no.
I think coming up this year. But that's far away, I think.
Awesome.
Cool.
Well, for everyone listening, definitely check out Manhattan and Grand Electrica. And stick around for... What did you say?
That was two applause.
Yeah, taste of the past. Sure.
Thank you, really studio good. Audience.
Thank you so much.
Joy Behar standing off.
Whoopi.
Thank you, Whoopi.
Brandon, who are you today?
I don't even know who else is on the McCain voice, girl. I'm probably the most annoying one. I'll tell you that.
All right, we'll work on a name for you. All right, stick around for a taste of the past up next, and we will see you guys next week. Thanks. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.